Good morning again. Happy Purim. We'll get to Purim in a moment. I just found this. First of all, there's a wonderful site, which I recommend, called Lions Roar, LION'S, Roar, ROAR. I found a piece of really nice discussion between Norman Fisher and a writer and somebody who works at Naropa called Carolyn Rose Jimian, and a very well-known Zen Buddhist, Bernie Glassman. So Norman says, "We the central tenet of Buddhism is our need to accept the pain is always present, and where's the humor in that?" So Norman Fisher says, "We are all in a mess, we're all miserable, and upset, and everything is terrible, and there's all the suffering, and we're trying to end suffering, and yet the teachings say in the end everything is fine." And this is a big joke. It's comical. Our human life is comical. Everything that Buddhism asks us to pay attention to, impermanence, suffering, egolessness, which may sound awful and frightening at first turns out to be good news. Impermanence is permanence, suffering is joy, egolessness is freedom. And the only trouble is that we don't notice that. Sometimes we knew that and we forgot. And that's kind of absurd, laughable, and slapstick. He goes on to say the whole proposition of human trouble is serious and not serious at the same time. And that paradox is essentially funny. Our whole world, including our Buddhist world, he says, and how we conduct ourselves always contains an element of humor. When I go to a big ceremony that's solemn and religious, I always feel I can take a step back and laugh. It's so severe and yet so funny at the same time. Don't you think so? Carolyn Rose then says, I would agree, but it also seems that the more one practices meditation, the more you lighten up and the more you can discover some kind of natural funniness in life. It's not just about formal practice, though. The more you live, the more you find to laugh about. There's a lot to cry about and a lot to laugh about. And then Bernie Glassman comes in saying, growing up as a Brooklyn Jew, humor was an essential part of my life. So even as I became a very serious Zen monk, beating people with a stick and doing all kinds of severe things, I was still this Jewish guy with lots of humor. And some people ask me what Judaism brought to Zen in America, and I always say a sense of humor. I don't think that Japanese Zen we inherited had much humor, although Chinese Zen had more. The article goes on, and it's a very wonderful article, and it's in Lion's Roar, and it's called Make Me One With Everything, which is the most famous Buddhist joke. The Dalai Lama asking the hot dog vendor, make me one with everything. And there are a number of sites that actually have Buddhist jokes. Some of them are quite obscure, some of them are not. So there is a very wonderful sort of introduction to what Purim is, and particularly what Norman said, our teacher Norman, that it's both things at the same time. And we try to get to that place too on Purim with the help of inebriation or whatever it takes. You know, today there's all different kinds of wonderful ways of getting to inebriation, to know, to be able to sort of reverse and overturn our traditional ways of seeing good and evil. For instance, you have to get to a place, according to one tradition, that you will not know how to distinguish between blessing Haman and cursing Mordechai. Interesting idea, again, of the fact that they're balanced. There's a yin and yang, etc., that we often don't pay attention to. That's why Purim is there. Okay, Purim. Everybody, I think, knows the story. In recent days, I've been reading quite a bit of how fundamentalist Christians are trying to take over the Esther story in a way that doesn't necessarily lead to, I believe, more freedom, but whatever. And the story, of course, is a story. It's a parody, P-A-R-O-D-Y. And that's so important for Jewish humor, because parody is an essential way of understanding what Jewish humor does, and turning things topsy-turvy. That's really what we're doing, the hafochma. We basically turn things over and over, and by doing so, At least one day a year, we begin to see things that we might not see before, and things that go on if you will, behind our behaviors, in a way. Even costuming is a very revelatory event. When one puts on a costume, puts on a mask, one seems to be freer to let the true self out, with the protection of the mask. And in many ways, I can tell about people's inner life by the costumes that they choose. So Purim and Mardi Gras, which was last a couple of weeks ago, and St. Patrick's Day, which will be this week, celebrated this week. All of them are called liminal holidays, liminal celebrations, because they're between things. And they all are based upon an ancient idea of Bacchanalia, where the breaking of the bonds of winter leads to the possibilities of spring. And breaking through is really one of the ideas behind Purim. You break through into a different demeanor. So you have these holidays. So it seems to be all of them involve inebriation. Later on, these Bacchanalian festivals can develop into what is called Carnival, which of course is celebrated throughout the Western world. And the Carnival, of course, leads to Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, which is immediately followed by Ash Wednesday, the beginning of a period of Lent. So that period of Lent lasts from Mardi Gras until Easter. One's supposed to give something up on Lent, etc. One is also, if you have friends who are Catholics, you might find that they do have ashes put on their heads after this morning service of Mardi Gras, after Ash Wednesday, and if you will, cross of ash on their foreheads, sort of as the beginning of an intimation of death and the ashes that follow. And of course, that leads to, for in the Christian tradition, to rebirth of Easter, the resurrection, etc. Purim Purim for us is again is a dangerous place. It's a dangerous place. It's seen a place of the possibility of fomenting, if you will, rebellion. For instance, if everybody in your congregation came dressed as the king, and the king walked in, who is the king? Right? There's a certain undermining of authority. We get that from the Purim story itself, which is a parody of the Persian court. Ahasuerus, the king, is played as a fool. Haman, the evil vizier, has a plan, of course, to destroy the Jews, and his essential reason for it, it's kind of why the story is so resonant for us in the diaspora. First of all, it's a story that doesn't necessarily use the word God in any way. Of course, that led all the rabbis to try to, bring God into it. But it's sort of, quote unquote, a secular book. Second, it is a tale which modeled many tales. And the reason Haman gives for wanting the Jews sort of eliminated is they don't act like us. They have their own laws, and thus they refuse to assimilate. They will acculturate, of course. I mean, Mordechai is an acculturated Persian Jew. He represents the Jewish community in Persia, and he has a relationship with the court, and that is a model as well of the court Jew, the illustrious Jew who serves as the representative of the community. And of course, we have Esther, her real name being, of course, Hadassah, which is why Hadassah is called what it is. Hadassah means myrtle, myrtle. You don't hear myrtles very often these days. Her name Esther is a queen name based upon the goddess Ishtar, and Mordechai is based upon the god of Marduk. So you have this. When the first people who heard the Megillah heard these names, they were like taken aback and say, "Oh, how can you make fun of the gods?" But that's part of what the Jewish tradition has, is we make fun of authority. Jewish humor makes fun of rabbis, particularly. They didn't like rabbis much. And we can go on and on, but I won't give you the entire history of Jewish humor here. But just to see it as an essential part of our intellectual tradition. And there were characters that emerged within the Jewish humor tradition who are antecedents of the contemporary stand-ups. And Purim became an avenue for these batchanim, as they're called, jesters, to emerge and to help in the possibility of turning things over and over in order to see what's going on behind it. These people took, if you will, license of Purim and would perform in many different ways. They would say poetry, they would do gramen, they would have entertainment. Later, they were joined by klezmer bands and music. And in some parts of the early medieval period, the Purim thing became quite raucous, and we would be burning effigies of Haman. We even have a warning in one of the early documents we have from, I believe, Venice, which warns non-Jews not to go into the Jewish quarter on Purim because it might be dangerous. So there's this idea of danger involved, and of course, there's also the complicated thing about seeing Haman as a descendant of Amalek, the tribe of marauders who attacked us on the way out of Egypt. Last Shabbat Zachor, we brought up that idea that this Amalekite ideology, the Amalekites have to be, if you will, erased. That's the word that's used. And unfortunately, in a number of times, there were people who took that in a very literal way. And we have the Baruch Goldstein massacre in the Cave of the Patriarchs in Hebron. And plus, the language that's being used, even in contemporary Israel, about the enemy being Amalek and thus has to be erased. So it's a dangerous kind of place. And that's what you happen when you allow yourself to sort of leave your normal parameters and go into another consciousness. I'm going to end right there because I talk a lot, and I'm going to hopefully get some comments and hopefully a good Buddhist joke or two and maybe a good Jewish joke. But as all of you know, there are a lot of mitzvot created by Purim, even though it's not a biblical holiday, even though Esther is in the Hebrew Bible, but it's not part of the five books where a lot of our mitzvot come from. We don't have a lot of mitzvot that come from the prophets, etc. And the mitzvot are wonderful ones. I mean, that's the nice thing about it. It's you should give gifts to the poor. You should give. It's the opposite of trick or treat. You should bring treats to your friends. You should have a wonderful meal, a mishteh. I mean, it's the idea of what, any day of the week. You know, it could be a Wednesday. You have a beautiful meal on Wednesday. And of course, the most well-known is listening to the Megillah. And if you notice, they're all starting with Mem. Mishteh, Megillah, Matanot Le'ev, Yunim, Mishloach Manot. It's interesting how they use the Mem. I'm not sure why exactly, but it works out nicely. Any reactions to this? I don't know, because Sylvia, my teacher, Sylvia Burstyn, she should live and be well, always noticed, always commented on the fact that when she looks at it, people meditating, it looks like they're scowling. Like they're somehow in some great turmoil, which is possibly true. We have great turmoil. And she would often suggest, can you put on a smile? Can you put on a smile? And in Buddhism, a character emerges much later called the Laughing Buddha, which you may have seen in tourist shops all over Chinatown, right? And the Laughing Buddha is someone who uses laughter and uses, if you will, to get us to a new state of mindfulness. Okie dokie. You want to stop the recording? And then you can give